Welcome to the Community Action League. The Community Action League is a weekly show that is a collaborative effort of local organizations and nonprofits. Our goal is to raise awareness of issues that impact people in Gallatin County, like consent, housing, transportation, human rights, and addiction. We also discuss the organizations that listeners can engage with that are relevant to these topics. On our show, we discuss the intersectionality, or connections, between these topics at the local, national, and global levels. If you're interested, you can tune to KGVM 95.9 Bozeman to learn about issues impacting your community every Thursday at 7 p.m. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or comments about our show, you can contact us at communityactionleague@gmail.com. Today we're talking about sexual health education in public schools in the United States. Our conversation will center around medically accurate information, statistics in our state, how schools decide what to teach, and the role of parents in this conversation. We'll be joined by a couple of teens that will be sharing their experiences and expertise with us. So my name is Cami, and I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator at BridgerCare. So BridgerCare's mission is to provide excellent, affordable reproductive and sexual health care and education in a safe, supportive, empowering atmosphere. We like to think that we offer priceless care that anyone can afford. And when we do our education, we realize that sometimes when you're teaching adolescents, they feel like you are lecturing down to them. So we have something called peer education, which is a group of local teens that get to learn about these issues and help teach their peers. So I'm going to turn it over to Alexina, who's going to tell us a little bit more about peer ed and what she does and why it's important to her.
Hello, I'm Alexina Lockie. I am a peer edder. This is my third year in peer ed. And peer ed is a program in which we get high schoolers to come to BridgerCare, and this is in partnership with Haven, and learn about sexual and reproductive health care, and then go out and teach it to the community. So that's just really exciting. And I joined because I felt like there was a really big need in Bozeman, and just kind of in general, for people to have accurate information so they could make accurate decisions. I think that oftentimes you can make good decisions, but if your information is bad, the good decision isn't actually going to be a good decision. That's why I joined peer ed.
And my name is Sadie, and this is my first year in peer ed. And I joined peer ed because I heard about it from some friends, and they basically told me about the really cool opportunities that peer ed has to offer, like going to many of the elementary schools as well as the high school, even MSU to teach topics such as sex ed, consent, and things like that that pertain to sexual health. And since I've joined, I've got to teach some sophomores at the high school about STIs, and I hope to teach more kids in the near future.
Yeah, and one more thing to note is that peer ed actually works with Haven as well. So we also talk about consent, healthy relationships, domestic violence, especially in teenagers. So that's a part of what we do as well.
And these kids are fierce advocates, so it's not just one of those things that you do, you know, once in a great while, every couple months get together. They are very committed, and they have to do a four-day retreat with us in the summer to get things started off, and then we meet every single week, because it's not just as straightforward as being like, you know, this behavior is healthy in a relationship, and this, you know, hitting is unhealthy. Done. Everybody's got it. Things are a lot more gray than that, especially around the healthy relationships piece of things. And when it comes to sexual health, there's as much time spent on talking about how we're going to talk about sexual health in a way that is, you know, non-judgmental, but also medically accurate and doesn't impose our own personal values on it, is there is actually learning the content of what we're going to teach about. And these are a lot deeper topics than we sometimes think they are. So these kids are super committed to coming every single week and learning about these topics so that they can be a resource not only to their peers in the classrooms when they're helping teach about these topics, but also informally in the hallways. And we've got one great peer educator who often talks in classes about, you know, if you see me in the hallway, you can just stop me anytime you have a question. And they are able to connect students to resources as they need them, not just when they're doing that sexual health unit in their health ed class. So I'm very honored to be able to work with these students. And there are 16 of them this year. Is that right?
I have no idea.
16 or 18, I think. Yeah.
Something I think it was 16 because we were like, I think we want to top it off at 16 last year. Mm-hmm. I don't remember.
We had a great problem last year, which was specifically we had more applicants than we could take. And we, every year, we screen our applicants. It's not just one of those things that anybody that wants to join can, because obviously it's a very sensitive topic and we need to make sure that it's being taught in a way that's, you know, by people that are willing to make sure that they are withholding their own personal opinions, but also there when other people need them. So it's definitely a screening process. And I think last year we had 17 applicants and we were only able to take 4 people because we could have had a group of 30, but that was not going to be a great size group to work with. So so today we're going to let the two of them weigh in a little bit on why sex ed is important. One thing we want to talk about first is there seems to be a lot of argument about what should be taught in schools with regards to sex ed. And the thing is, it's not necessarily that people argue about whether or not to teach sex ed in schools. There seems to be disagreement about what to teach. So there's a whole lot of surveys a person can look at between, you know, 1999 and 2015. But they all pretty much conclude the same thing, whether they're being done by conservative groups, by groups that folks might think are liberal, by groups that people think are more middle of the road. They all kind of come to the same consensus that kids should get some education about sex in schools. The problem is that people don't know what they should be teaching, whether they should be teaching you should wait until you're married to have sex, whether you should be talking about condoms, whether there should be discussion about consent, whether there should be discussion about healthy relationships and that sort of thing. So now we're gonna talk a little bit about where we get our ideas about sex. And Sadie, as a teenager, you might have some thoughts about where we get these ideas from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. So a lot of people get ideas about sex from things like media, from other friends or peers, in a church setting, or even from family. We firmly believe that parents are the best people to help their kids establish their values around sexuality. However, not all kids are comfortable talking to their parents about sexuality, which is where the media or peers or religious leaders come into play. Information about sex can honestly come from anywhere. It is very important to know that when you are speaking with peers that they may not have medically accurate information to give you. Along with the media, you cannot trust what you see in movies. You cannot let that be your guide for sex and relationships. As well as churches and families can have very strong opinions, and it is totally okay to have a different opinion than what your religious leader or your parents or a family member has. It is important to know what you value and to know what your personal beliefs about sex and relationships are and to go from there. And also, this is just a side note, but it is very important to never Google sexual health information. If you have questions about a certain topic that could be related to sex, go and come to BridgerCare, talk to somebody, or go to a trusting adult. You could ask a friend, anybody, but do not Google it.
Absolutely, and I totally agree with that one. We had one freshman student a couple of years ago who really wanted to argue with us in one of the classrooms about blue waffles because his mom had showed him pictures of blue waffles. And does one of you want to tell us anything about blue waffles? Does either of you know anything about blue waffles?
I can't say I do.
Which is actually
very vaguely.
It's good news that these two don't know about blue waffles because it's actually something that was made up by the internet. These aren't waffles that are dyed blue. The internet, Google, people posted images on Google of people whose genitals were colored blue, and they said there's a sexually transmitted infection out there that if you get it, your genital region will turn bright blue, and that's how you know you should go to a doctor. And this is not real. And it was very interesting because in this particular class, not just that student, but other students were like, no, we've seen the pictures. It's real. There's proof. And it's not. You can, even if you Google blue waffles, which please do not do. But if a person Googles blue waffles, they see that there's discussion of how it's actually not real. But there's a lot of bad information out there. And a lot of people read, you know, firsthand accounts of things that people do or don't like about different types of contraceptive methods that may not be the norm for folks as a whole. And so it's always really good, like Sadie said, to just ask a healthcare provider. They can give you accurate information and they can point to medically accurate studies that have been done with, you know, a large enough group of people to actually find statistically significant information. So definitely talking to parents is a great way for kids to help establish their own values, as Sadie said, but we know, like she said, that not everybody does that. So a 2015 study published by the Family and Youth Services Bureau surveyed nearly 1,500 eighth graders in Eastern Massachusetts, and they found that only about half of those teens had ever talked to their parents about sex. So that's half of teens talking to their parents about sex, but 60% of them had talked to an extended family member or family friend about issues like dating, relationships, sex, teen pregnancy, and parenthood, including things like protection methods like condoms and being gay.
And going off of what Cammie just said, it's very important to remember that sex is a very emotional topic, and sometimes it is hard to go to a friend or a family member with such an intense emotional topic. So there are always other options like counselors. Like Cammie said, healthcare providers are going to be 100% medically accurate information. They can help you with problems pertaining to sex. And it's just very important to know that there are people out there for you that you can talk to that are completely confidential. It's very important to remember that there are people out there to talk to if you should need that.
Mm-hmm. And on the topic of parents, who are obviously a great resource for kids, not only do they not always give the best information if they don't have it, and a lot of parents, we just encourage them to go looking for the information with your children, because a parent might see blue waffles and realize that's not real, and have a longer conversation or have a better idea of where they can go look for medically accurate information online. So parents can be helpful in that way too. But we do have, there are plenty of parents out there as well that just don't want to recognize that the extent to which kids understand sexuality or to which they have been exposed to it. Like Sadie mentioned, they might be seeing it in the media. I mean, how many times even as adults have we Googled, you know, something random and a porn site has popped up? I remember taking care of a 7-year-old girl who typed in, I think it was Barbie.com, and porn popped up and she was very upset and concerned and didn't know what was going on. But a lot of parents just, we want to keep our babies forever, and that makes absolute sense, but it's not always, you know, what's happening in their lives. I've definitely had an 8th grade mother in the last couple of years tell me she didn't think her 14-year-old daughter even knew what sex was. And she was very concerned that we would be talking about sexually transmitted infections with her daughter. And she could have been right, but her daughter went to a public school, or I should just say she went to a school. It doesn't matter if it's public or private. And she's around other kids and she's talking to her peers and she's seeing things, you know, on TV, whether that's at home or when she's not with her family, or maybe she's watching things on her phone that her parents don't know about. And, you know, parents don't always want to recognize what their kids may or may not know. So it's first knowing what ages you should be talking about specific things, and then making sure that your children get that information from you first. So if they've already seen porn and they think that's what sex is supposed to look like, and you've decided they're too young to even talk about it, that's now what they think is expected of them in their relationships in the future. So it's better for parents to kind of head off at the pass and to be the first person to talk to their kids about issues around sexuality. And it does need to start young. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and she learned this more at school than from me, but it still makes me very happy. She talks about, it's my body. And it's hilarious because she loves to use it, especially against her father. But over Thanksgiving, we were visiting lots of our family, and so many of them just wanted to kiss on her and kiss on her and kiss on her. And sometimes she'd say, no, it's my body, and then walk away. And that's great. At a young age, she has learned that it doesn't matter who you are in her life. If she doesn't want you to touch her, you can't touch her. And kids pick this up at a young age, and she doesn't even necessarily understand that this is something that's a bigger concern necessarily when she's older, that she should have control over her body and letting somebody touch her in other places that don't seem just as innocent and gentle as a kiss on the cheek from grandma. But I still want her to always understand that it's her body. So yes, parents can be an excellent resource for kids, and schools can be an excellent resource for kids as well, for the medically accurate side of things, less the values side of sexuality. So Alexina, do you want to talk to us a little bit about how schools or teachers or the entire United States decides what sexuality education to provide?
Of course. So it's actually really interesting because there's no really federal thing at all about sex ed, so it's really up to the states, and the things that the states decide are very different from one another. Okay, so Montana is one of 24 states, including the District of Columbia, well, not including, but also the District of Columbia, which mandates sex ed. They also mandate HIV education. I'm not completely sure of the difference between that, but I do believe that means that specifically you have to talk about HIV. That information is not required to be medically accurate, which is really where peer ed comes in. We come in with information which, to the best of our knowledge and abilities, we know is medically accurate. So with Montana as well, sex education is allowed to promote religion, and it's allowed to be biased, things of that nature. So it's really important for me, and I think for a lot of people who are involved in this sort of work, to make sure that this information is being presented in an unbiased and medically accurate way. And part of the thing is that since Montana really has only two things that it says needs to happen with sex ed, which is that it's mandated and that HIV should also be talked about, everything else is really, really left up to the districts and stuff like that. And that's really influenced by whatever parent calls in. So there have been times where peer ed has not gone into the schools because of parent calls. And then there have been times that we've been brought in because of parent calls and things of that nature. So that leaves a lot of what you learn in schools to the nature of parent phone calls, which is probably not the safest system to make sure that people get the same amount or the accurate amounts of sexual education.
Going off of that too, the fact that there have been years when there has been no sexual education, years when there has been, that leaves students, teens, whatever age you want to talk about, that leaves a big gap in what people know and what others don't. For example, a current sophomore in high school could know what's going on, you know, with their body and with healthy relationships and with sexual health, whereas a newly graduated a senior could not know that. They could not know that same information just because perhaps they were not taught sex ed at the same time that these kids are being now. Going off of that, there are certain benchmarks in Montana that we hope that by the end of each grade, students do know. So fourth grade, students are expected to be able to identify personal health enhancing strategies that encompass disease prevention. By the end of eighth grade, they are expected to be able to explain relationships between positive behaviors and the prevention of disease, and explain personal health enhancing strategies that encompass sexual activity and disease prevention. By the end of grade 12, they are supposed to be able to analyze how attitudes and behaviors can impact health and disease prevention, explain the impact of personal health on body systems, including the reproductive system, develop personal health enhancing strategies that encompass sexual activity and disease prevention.
Absolutely, and those benchmarks come specifically from the Montana Office of Public Instruction, and they leave a lot of kind of gray area and open-endedness. So all it really has much to talk about is preventing disease, which is great, but there are definitely a lot of ways that people could go about that. So that leaves it kind of open. And one other thing to mention is the fact that, as Sadie said, kids might be getting differing levels of education across different years, but they could even be getting different levels across teachers, especially like at Bozeman High. Those students that take online gym is obviously going to be a very different sexual and reproductive health unit than if they are able to take that in person. Not just at Bozeman High, in Bozeman, Belgrade, Big Sky, West Yellowstone, any of our local Gallatin Valley high schools, teachers can each choose what they feel like is important to be included. And so some teachers might be teaching different things than other teachers.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to note that on the benchmarks, a lot of it talks about disease, which kind of goes back to one of the other things, which I do believe I forgot to mention, which is that Montana says that schools must cover abstinence. So no other thing really is said to need to be covered other than abstinence. And I think that oftentimes it is covered in a disease prevention sort of way. So if you are abstinent, that is the only 100% way to not get an STI most of the time. There are some exceptions, but, you know, whatever.
Do you want to tell us about those exceptions, Alexandra?
Okay, sure. Some of those exceptions are you can get an STI from your mother. So if she gives birth, she has an STI. So one of the might be HIV can be transmitted in that manner. And then there are other ones such as sharing needles, other things like that. You could not get STIs from toilet seats. That's just putting that out there, everyone. And so because Montana oftentimes really talks about things in a preventing disease sort of oriented way, it really emphasizes abstinence and oftentimes not so many other things, forms of contraception or things like that. And that's another thing that Bridger Care and Peer Ed really strives to talk about, is other methods that are not just abstinence, because I would say the majority of students do know what abstinence is. It's a pretty easy concept to grasp.
Absolutely. And one other thing that we often talk about in classrooms as well is abstinence is a choice that someone makes, and sometimes that choice is taken from a person in the form of sexual assault. So if a person is ever sexually assaulted, they may still need to be tested for sexually transmitted infections, and they may still need a pregnancy test, even though they are abstinent, and they continue to be abstinent. So definitely things to consider. It's a pretty straightforward concept that most kids get, but there are a few nuances to it that are worth talking about as well. So yeah, abstinence seems like a pretty easy idea to grasp, but when we talk about abstinence-only education, what does that actually mean versus other types of education, sometimes known as like comprehensive education? Sadie, why don't you tell us about the differences?
Yeah, for sure. So abstinence-only education, essentially, the message is essentially no sex until marriage. So with abstinence-only education, the expected standard for all people is that sex outside of marriage is likely to have harmful psychological and physical side effects, for example, an STI or an unwanted pregnancy or unwanted emotional turmoil. The problem with abstinence-only education is that there are students that have had sex or that are having sex or that plan to have sex in the near future, and it is difficult for these students sometimes to listen to or to respond to abstinence-only education because they could find themselves feeling in an uncomfortable situation, or they could feel as though they are being talked down upon for the decisions that they have made. So it is easy for those students to stop paying attention and then potentially miss important information on STIs or unplanned pregnancies or anything regarding sexual health that could be important to them. So with comprehensive sexual education, that's a little bit different, as in it encompasses sexually transmitted infections or STIs, whereas abstinence teaches that the most effective way to avoid STIs in pregnancy is through not having sex. Comprehensive education also teaches safe sex practices. Abstinence is one of those. However, they talk about contraception such as condoms and limiting number of sexual partners. So in a comparison done on authentic abstinence education and comprehensive education that was conducted in 2004, it was noted that healthy relationships in comprehensive sex ed was completely disregarded. It was not being taught whatsoever. And in authentic abstinence, it was actually being taught 17.4%, which is definitely something.
Part of the reason for that most likely is because they've grouped in this study healthy relationships and benefits of marriage. And since the abstinence thing is all about no sex before marriage, it seems logical that marriage would be talked about. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it's talking about healthy relationships in the sense that we as peer ed talk about them.
And from the Haven side of things, where you two and myself as well get to learn each week about healthy relationships and why that is important, does either of you want to talk about why you think it would be important to talk about, you know, what is healthy, unhealthy, and abusive in classrooms when talking about sexual health?
So as Emily, who is our coordinator from Haven, likes to say, sex does not happen in a vacuum. And that's very true. Things that happen around sex are large contributing factors to the experience and to the way that it is viewed. One of those things is the relationship. Is it coerced? Did the person give consent? Was it rape? You know, that sort of thing is actually very important when we're talking about sex, especially like when we're talking about abstinence. Do you still consider someone who was raped abstinent because they never made the decision to have sex? You know, things like that are actually really hard to just have an answer to. And that is a lot of the reason why I believe, and I would say everyone else in peer ed, believes that it is important to be talking about these things, because it opens up a conversation that's really essential to understanding sex and the things that happen from around it.
And it's also important to know that having this conversation with your children or with your parents, either way, it does not mean that it doesn't have to be a bad conversation. There is a lot of stigma around the big sex talk where You know, basically, it's very stigmatizing. It's a bad conversation. It's an uncomfortable conversation. But really, it does not have to be. As long as you have medically accurate information that is unbiased, I mean, you can't really go wrong with that. And sharing that with your parents or with your children is a very important thing, and it's a very big part of open communication. And it's a very important factor of a relationship.
Absolutely, and I like what you're saying about how it seems like this conversation that everybody dreads, and it's like, oh no, I'm busy, go ask your mom, I'm busy, go ask your dad, I'm busy, go ask whatever other parent, your grandparents, whoever, an uncle, someone, anyone that isn't me. So many families don't want to talk about, you know, have the talk, as they often call it. But the thing is, when we think about sexuality, we have a tendency to think about, you know, the type of sexual act that leads to you know, the birth of a child, but there's so much more to sexuality. It can actually be broken down into at least 6 pieces, and only one of those pieces is reproductive health and genitals, right? Another piece is that relationship side of things. Another piece is talking about love and affection. These are ongoing conversations that we should be having with our kids at every age. Body image falls into sexuality, right? And it's obviously important to be talking to our young children about having a healthy body image, that they don't need to look necessarily like Barbie. That doesn't need to be part of the talk the one time you have it, because you can be having this talk in an ongoing way. And you should also include other pieces of sexuality, which include things like sexual orientation and, you know, gender role and identity. And I don't know that we'll have time today to talk about some of those stereotypes that happen around gender, but definitely a lot of kids feel very much like they have to act a certain way because of the gender that they are perceived to be. So it's very interesting that we'll often teach like kindergarten kids, and you'll have little boys that are already like, that football is a boy's toy, girls can't play with it, or that'll laugh at the fact that a little boy might play with a doll, and it's unfair because they've already believed that these things are something that they just, you have to be this way because you are seen as a boy or a girl.
And then one of the things that we do when we're teaching is we do gender boxes, and we basically make a male box and a female box, and we have students put, you know, the stereotypical things like Cammy was saying, football in the mailbox, or sports, or beards, facial hair, you know, suit and tie, all that stuff in the mailbox. And then in the female box, they put things like makeup, periods, long hair, all those kinds of things. And basically what they do is they erase the lines on the boxes and essentially prove the point that no matter what gender you have the right to your own beliefs, your own style, your own orientation. You know, it's whatever you want, because you're a human being and you're given those rights. So it's very important that we teach that as well, going off of what Cammy said.
Absolutely.
And then another interesting thing about that gender box activity is that as we do it over several grades. So what's the youngest grade that we do it with?
The kindergartners, we actually just pull out toys and we say, is this a boy toy or a girl toy? And then older kids, we do the boxes. I think starting often in like fourth grade, you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And we do it two older grades as well. Okay. And what you find is that you get the same sort of overall things, but the specifics are very different. So as you get older, it's much more about sex and relationships. And it's like, oh, the guy's gonna propose, he's gonna initiate sex. The girl should be chaste, but then not. I don't know. It's confusing.
The one we hear a lot is, what is it? A lady in the street, but a freak in the sheets. And we're always like, yep, let's write that. Okay.
And what you find is that these same sort of ideas and stereotypes that exist from really young, as Cammy was saying, kindergarten, is this a boy toy or a girl toy, transform into beliefs about sexual behavior and things of that nature. And so it's really important to be stressing these earlier conversations so that the conversations later on have a good basis.
And also things like that stigma around certain objects or behaviors can also be very detrimental to people who don't know what their sexual identity is yet, you know, to people that are trying to figure that out. It can be very difficult for them to listen to, for a male, for example, to listen to the stereotypes for a male and the stereotypes for a woman and find that he relates more to the women's stereotypes and the male stereotypes. And that's just something that not everybody is accepting of, and that's something that definitely needs to be educate, you know, people need to be educated on that because it is a very, very real thing. And it's very important to get the message across because some people are dealing with this, and it's very nice to have support from friends, family, even just peers. It doesn't even have to be a friend, but it's nice to have support out there for people.
Another thing that's often missing from both comprehensive and abstinence-only sex education is discussion about consent and sexual assault. And it can be couched many different ways. You know, like I mentioned earlier, my two-year-old talks about, it's my body. And clearly that's a very different conversation you're going to be having with a two-year-old or with a kindergartner than you're having with a high school student. But consent and boundaries, as we often call it, can definitely be taught at all grades and all levels. So let's talk for a minute about coercion and what the states are doing about that.
So according to this most recent thing on all of the requirements for sex ed in the states, it says that 25 states and the District of Columbia, but interestingly not Montana, just put that out there for a sec, require that sex education include information about skills for avoiding coerced sex. So that's really interesting for me because it isn't about coercive sex per se, it's about avoiding coerced sex, which concerns me a little bit because it's as though one should be avoiding coerced sex, one needs to always be on the lookout, when it really shouldn't be that way. Coercing someone into sex is a crime, and the victim of that is a victim of a crime. And it is, I would say in a lot of ways, it can be perceived as stigmatizing for those people because it's all about their role as opposed to other people's.
Absolutely, and one thing that people often don't think about is, we often have teenage students who say things like, well, they just couldn't help themselves, they were just so turned on they couldn't stop. And that's not what sexual assault is about. Sexual assault isn't that somebody just physically could not stop themselves, it's about having power over someone else. When somebody has taken your power from you, it makes you feel like you do not have the power necessarily to move on from there. And we do see a lot of victim blaming in our society for different reasons, but especially when it comes to things like sexual assault, because teaching folks to avoid coercion is like teaching them to not drink when they're around people of the opposite sex, or not being out after dark alone, or not wearing short skirts, and it's putting the onus on them to prevent them from being assaulted.
Exactly, and going off of that too, there is a lot of stigma around the clothing that females wear, and I would just like to clarify to anybody that might have been confused, that the clothing a female chooses to wear, or the way she chooses to conduct herself, or the how much she decides to drink, or anything like that, none of those things mean that the female wants sex.
Yeah, and if that were the case, that clothing has to do with it, you would see lower rates of rape and sexual assault in countries such as Saudi Arabia. You would see higher rates during the summer, all of that sort of stuff, and you don't see that. It's not about clothes. It never has been about clothes. It's about power. It's about control. You can see lots of armies used rape as a demoralizing tactic. They would kill men and rape women because the raping of the women was a way to break the morale of them. And that is just one example of why it is really, really important to actually be talking about these issues, because they are very severe and they can impact people for a long time. So I do believe that the most recent statistic, I could be wrong of course, is that 1 in 4 women have experienced some form of sexual assault. And that's something that I think a lot of teachers have in mind when they don't talk about it at school. It's because it's something that statistically, like 5 of the people in the class, probably actually a little less, but you know, something around that, have experienced in their life. And I think that a lot of the teachers have fear about bringing that up. Because it can open a lot of hard wounds, and especially you don't know how the class is going to react. If you know, for example, that one student has experienced something personal like that, you're not sure how the other students in the class will react, and you might just not want to bring that up. And so because of that, I mean, there's other reasons, of course, as well, but one of the reasons that this isn't talked about is because of that fear. And so we like to come in as peer ed and talk about these things, even though they can be hard, because they affect 1 in 4 women, and a lower rate for men, but still a rate.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those things, too, that when we hear 1 in 4 women will be sexually assaulted in their lives, and that is the statistic from the CDC, we think that it's just a problem with women, and that must also mean that 1 in 4 men are rapists. And that's a very difficult thing for people to wrap their head around. And that's not necessarily the case. So what we see is folks who sexually assault, often they do it once and they get away with it, so they do it again and again and again. And I believe the rate is, for folks that have been convicted and eventually sent to prison, 5 to 7 times they've gotten away with it and they've continued to do it. So they've, you know, sexually assaulted 5 to 7 different women. And so it's not 1 in 4 men assaulting 1 in 4 women. And it's not even always men assaulting women. And that's the other problem with talking about consent and coercion from the avoiding side of things, because it usually focuses specifically just on women. And there are, any gender can be sexually assaulted, and there any gender can be the perpetrator of a sexual assault. And so by focusing more on everybody in the relationship from both sides should be able to say no and should definitely have their wishes respected, definitely kind of opens that up to talking to those victims as well, or future victims that are not necessarily women or do not identify as women. But to get back on track a little bit, let's talk a little bit more about countrywide, what we see from states teaching things. Alexina, do you have some other statistics about what other states require, don't you, for be taught in their sex ed?
Yeah. So 12 states require that sexual orientation be taught about. 9 of those 12 states require that it be inclusive towards people of varying sexual orientations, but 3 say that it has to be negative. And those states are Alabama, South Carolina, and Texas. And those have not changed for quite a while, actually. And that's something that's really interesting and, for me, a bit sad, personally, because I assume that sexual orientation does not vary in Texas, South Carolina, and Alabama, that the same number of students identify as LGBT+, and yet they are being taught negative things, often about themselves or their identity. And so that's another really important thing that we should discuss when it comes to sex ed in schools, is what is it actually telling students to believe about themselves and to believe about the world around them? Because sex is something that really plays into the things that we do. And the education that you have on it really can change your worldview.
That is so true. I mean, without sex, nobody would be here. I mean, sex is a natural human function that is essential to life. And it's very important to remember that and to not make it something that it isn't, you know?
So yeah, sex is definitely something that continues the species, absolutely. And when we talk about sex, usually when we say sex, we're speaking specifically about penile vaginal sex. And you know, the thing that goes off and creates a baby, which is probably part of the reason that a lot of states feel like they don't need to address the LGBTQ community, is because if there's not a penis and a vagina involved and there can't be a baby, why do we even need to bother? But what we are seeing is a larger and larger number of people identifying as part of this population. And even though the types of sex that they have may or may not be able to lead to conception, to a baby, definitely there are still risks of sexually transmitted infections. These relationships, as we talked about, not happening in a vacuum, they still need to be learning about healthy relationships, what is unhealthy, what is abusive, what are some warning signs of that, you know, as well as just feeling like they're included in the classroom when talking about sexual health. And so we do see a larger number of folks identifying as part of the LGBTQ community. Specifically, Gallup every year since at least 2012 has done a study where they ask folks, do you identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and or transgender? And those are the only options people have, and they can say yes or no. And we've seen that rate grow what I would consider to be a fairly substantial amount. So back in 2012, about 3.5% of the population that they polled identified as part of the LGBTQ community. And it's moved from 2012 to 2017 from 3.5% to 4.5% of the entire population saying, or I should say of the folks polled, saying, yes, I do identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. But one thing that's important to note is that these numbers vary based on the generation that people were born. So for example, if you're looking at folks that were born back, you know, in the 1940s, 50s, and early 60s, only about 3.5%, or sorry, no, only about 2.4% of them identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. But in 2017, for those folks between the ages of 18 and 37, 8.2% of them identified as part of the LGBTQ community, and 8.2 is a substantial number. And we don't have good numbers here in the state of Montana on the number of teens that identify that way. That's not something that a study has been done on that we've been able to find. But if we assume they're in a similar number category as millennials, that's 8% of them. So that's in every classroom, 1 to 2 to 3 people who is being left out of the conversation if all we're talking about is a penis and a vagina.
Yeah, and another thing that's interesting is that as we see people be more inclusive towards LGBT people, the numbers rise. And it's possible that that's because just there are more people in our generation, by our, I mean Generation Z, or younger people, who identify as LGBT just because that's the way they were born. And it can also just be because older generations might be uncomfortable about their sexual orientation. And so I think that it's really important that we talk about sexual orientation in an inclusive way so that we don't have this issue of people feeling as though they have to hide their sexual orientation.
Absolutely, and definitely when it comes to this education, when talking about sex in schools, you have to be so careful, not just with the LGBTQ community, but with so many other things. You can't make assumptions about students who have intellectual or developmental or physical disabilities not being sexual beings, because they still are too, and they still need to be included in the conversation. You can't, if you're in front of a classroom and you're, you know, saying something shaming about being a teen parent, that might be someone's sister, that might be them, that might be their mother. My mother had my sister when she was 17 and me when she was 18. So I always want to be really careful when I'm talking to classes to not talk about how, you know, teens are not ready to be parents, because there are plenty of adults that aren't ready to be parents. And there are plenty of teens that are just doing their best to try to raise their children. And in talking about sexuality can be so difficult in classrooms, because you do want to include those students who very firmly believe that they should not have sex until they're married. But you also want to include those students who have maybe been sexually active for 1 or 2 or 3 years, and you want to make sure that everything you say is being inclusive of those students who have been sexually assaulted, and in a way that they don't feel like they're being re-traumatized. And so that's especially why I love my peer educators, because they take the time every week to keep learning about these issues, to be more sensitive, and to make sure that they're being as sensitive as they can be in the classroom.
So as we were saying before, you can't just always know at what age people are having sex, or just assume that people are or aren't having sex. But in Montana every year, there's something called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which asks high school students around the nation. But specifically, we are looking at statistics for Montana. And these show that overall 43.2% of high school students have had sexual intercourse. And that in ninth grade, that is 23.8%. But by 12th grade, that's 63.9%. So that's a decent amount of people that by ninth grade have had sexual intercourse. We don't know exactly when this is, because the Youth Risk Behavior Survey isn't just always done at like the exact end of the year or the exact beginning of the year. So was it in eighth grade or was it in ninth grade? We don't know. But what we do know is that there is a significant number of students who are having sex rather young.
And going off of what Alexina just said, we asked several classes of high school freshmen in this area how many of their fellow freshmen they thought had sex before, and the classes responded that most of them, or they guessed 70 to 90%, had had some sort of sexual activity before. And that's very important because, I mean, freshmen, how old is that? Probably 14, 15?
Mm-hmm.
So the legal age of consent in Montana...
13, 14, yes.
And that's important because the legal age of consent in Montana is 16. And so, although that's not going to stop anybody from having sex before age 16, that is the law. So it is it's even more important to branch education to younger students, per se, 7th and 8th graders, because I personally know people that have been having sex in 7th grade. And I know that in middle school, the sexual education that I received was abstinent-based sexual education. And that doesn't do a whole bunch when it comes to students that already are sexually active and could need information like contraception, STI information, even unplanned pregnancy information. And it's very important to reach out to those students in a safe way where they can get that information. Because of course it's important to remember, 7th and 8th graders can't drive themselves to Bridgercare. Not all 7th and 8th graders have parents that are okay with sexual activity at such a young age. So they really don't have access to contraception, to information on anything, whether it be their bodies, whether it be unplanned pregnancy, whether it be sexual orientation. They don't really have that information. So it's very important to reach out to them and to give them that information that they need so that they can make safe, healthy decisions that will instead of hurting them, help them.
Absolutely. And like Sadie said, so many of the classes of freshmen said they thought, you know, 70% or more of students had sex by freshman year. And, you know, the truth is it's 24%. So definitely it's not as high as they always have a tendency to think that it is. That having been said, as Sadie also mentioned, middle school, you know, it's students that may not have had very good information either about healthy relationships or may not know if they're in a healthy relationship. You know, are these seventh graders having sex with other seventh graders or are they having sex with college kids? And that's definitely, you know, maybe a very, very unhealthy and abusive situation. And just by not even having that information being given to them can really make it difficult for them to recognize that they may be being coerced in a way that they don't want to be, or they should not be. I guess that's the point of coercion, right? Is talking somebody into doing something they don't want to do. There's definitely other things, though, that we can learn from the Montana Youth Risk Behavior Survey as well, including like the percentage of students who drank alcohol or used drugs before they had sex the last time.
What you find is that the number of students who drank alcohol or used drugs before less sexual intercourse goes down across grade levels, according to age. In 9th grade, it is 18.9%. 10th grade, 18.7%, 11th grade, 18.4%, and then for 12th grade, 16.3%. So what you see is that it's, in my opinion, and I would say in pretty much everyone's opinion, it is healthier not to be under the influence of something before having sex. And that actually goes down as the grades go up. So you do see that there's a correlation between safe sexual behaviors and age, which is possibly linked with the sexual education given at that time, because by 9th grade you probably have not been taught about drinking alcohol in combination with sex.
Absolutely, and that's something we like to talk about when we get the opportunity to educate about consent, is the fact that someone who is under the influence of drugs or alcohol cannot consent to sex specifically. And of course it's hard to explain to a 14-year-old who is too young to drink or drive, but if you're too young to drive, or sorry, if you are too drunk to drive, then you are too drunk to consent to sex. Because it's one of those things that we get a lot of questions in our anonymous question box about, I think I said yes, but I don't really remember. And that's, if a person's not in a state of mind where they can clearly make decisions, then they're not in a good state of mind to be deciding whether or not they want to have sex. And that's just something that we have to fight against in our culture, that we need to, you know, lower someone's inhibitions in order to get them to have sex with us. That's not romantic, that's a little bit creepy. And if somebody doesn't want to have sex with us, or we don't feel comfortable having sex with someone else without being drunk or high, then we should, maybe we're not ready to actually do that with them. So we like to be able to give that education to kids whenever possible. Some other things we learn from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey are about, you know, condom use and use of highly effective contraceptive methods for kids that are sexually active. And that is, I think, kids that have had sex at least once in the last 3 months is people they consider to be sexually active. So what we actually see is condom usage among students who are sexually active goes down from 9th grade to 12th grade. You're less likely to use a condom if you were a senior in high school, but you're more likely to use a method of contraception if you're in high school that is not a condom. So things like a pill, the pill, an IUD, an implant, a shot, the patch, any of those things. We see that, and there's likely a correlation between those two, that folks are thinking, well, now I'm covered against pregnancy, so I don't need to use a condom anymore. And that's one issue that also has to be covered and stressed when talking about sex ed in schools, is the fact that just because you're using contraception does not mean that you do not still need to use a condom, because you can still get an STI. And that's another reason, too, that we often see some of these STI rates being higher among the gay community is because they think, well, there's no risk of pregnancy. I don't need to use a condom. And not thinking about the fact that I can still get or give an STI to someone else.
Yeah, and specifically talking about safe sex in the LGBT community, that's something just to start off with isn't really talked about often. But okay, so there was a study, I believe, in New York where they interviewed, or not interviewed, where they followed, I don't know what the correct verb right there would be, about 5,000 lesbian and bisexual high schoolers, female, and then found that they actually had a higher rate of teen pregnancy than their straight peers. And that's most likely due to a lack of information or just that sort of thought of like, oh, well, I don't really need to pay attention because I'm a lesbian. When in reality, these sorts of things are important pretty much for everyone to hear. And we don't know exactly the reasons behind that, but it is something that's really interesting to note and to talk about.
Well, and on that note, it's very interesting. We often hear about people, you know, experimenting in college. And people of any sexual orientation can experiment. And so it's important when thinking about your sexual health is not just to think, well, I identify as a lesbian, but to think, am I ever going to have sex with someone with a penis? Because if so, I might need to think about a contraceptive method, even though it might just be a one-time thing and I would never have to worry about it again.
It's also important to note that contraceptive use can be relevant to people who aren't even at risk. I say that in a weird tone because at risk is maybe the wrong word for that, of becoming pregnant. So for example, you might have someone who identifies as a lesbian who uses contraceptive methods such as an IUD, NuvaRing, Nexplanon, something along those lines to reduce symptoms that go along with periods or things of that nature, or possibly just to put their mind at ease. Sometimes that's just nice.
And also, I'm not going to go too deep into birth control right now or contraception, but it's important to talk to your healthcare provider as well as a trusted adult, a parent, about the risks and the benefits of contraception. And it's very important to really take your time and think about which method is right for you rather than just jumping into some birth control because you want to be sexually active. It's very important to take the time and really, because sex is it's a mature thing, and it's important to be mature in all aspects of sex. And one of the most important aspects is the healthy part of it. You know, if you're not ready for a child, then it's important to decide how you're going to prevent from having a child. And contraception is the way to go for that. So it's very important to make a very logical, very smart decision about what's right for you.
Absolutely. And we started out this conversation talking about the parents' role in educating their children and making sure to talk to them about various aspects of sexuality, not just how a penis goes into a vagina and can make a baby, but, you know, the gender side of things and sexual orientation and what's appropriate for love and affection, unhealthy and healthy relationships and things like that. And we highly advocate that all parents should know what is being taught specifically to their children, whether they're receiving education about sex from schools, from a church group, from any sort of place like that, because there are things that, like we talked about, that get left out of either abstinence-only education or might be left out of comprehensive sexual health education. We talked a little bit about how, you know, neither one of them spends much time talking about healthy relationships. Neither one of them necessarily spend a lot of time talking about coercion and consent and boundaries and how your boundaries deserve to be respected and how to ask somebody, you know, how to ask in a relationship, what are your boundaries, and make sure you know mine so we can respect them. And then a lot of folks argue that schools leave out conversation about the beauty of sex, you know, the pleasure that comes from it, and that it should be pleasurable for both parties. And we absolutely understand that in peer ed, but we also really like our jobs and we like teaching in the schools. And so if you are one of those people that really feels like your children should definitely know that there is pleasure to be had from sex, they're probably not learning that in school. So that's something you're going to definitely want to be able to talk to them about, and other things as well.
And when it comes to who's teaching sex ed in schools, in some cases it's the teachers doing it themselves or the school nurses, or there's a standardized curriculum that all students across the school systems get. But in other cases, guest speakers are invited in to teach part or all of the sex education unit for a particular grade level.
And so to the best of our knowledge, there are only two groups that teach in the public schools here in the Gallatin Valley. One of them is us here at Bridger Care, and as the peer educator, educators already talked about. We only focus on education that is medically accurate. It is age appropriate. We attempt to be culturally sensitive with respect to race, religion, the LGBTQ community, and stick to things that are just the facts on things. We don't share our opinions because it is, we firmly believe that it is never okay to press your values onto someone else. We also tailor all of our education to the institution's perceived needs. So if a school says, I really want you to teach my seventh graders about contraception, we can talk about that. And if they say, you know, we only want to talk about STIs with our freshmen, we will do our best to accommodate that as well. But we are never okay on the Bridger Care side with telling kids that they are expected to wait until they are married to have sex. We definitely feel like if that is a value a person holds, that is very, very valid. But they should not be having that conversation necessarily in the school setting.
And also going off of that, abstinence is a choice that each individual should make themselves. It is very important to, and it's very important to let them do that too on their own. Some organizations do believe in abstinence-based education, and that is actually, by the CDC, that was proven that abstinence-based education is less effective. And so it's very important to state the facts and to leave bias out of it completely, because sex is such a, it's a very important thing, and that it should be everybody's personal decision whether or not they want to have sex, with whom, you know, it's all up to the person having sex.
Yes, like I mentioned, there's one other group that teaches some sex education in the Bozeman area, and that is Zoe Care. And their mission statement is to serve the parents and save the child with medical excellence in the love of Christ. And so a lot of the education that Zoe Care provides may have a religious bias to it, which is definitely allowed under Montana law and is something that some parents and administrators may want for children to learn, and maybe something that some of the adolescents want to learn, but just being aware of what is being taught to your children in the various schools.
And Zoe Care predominantly teaches to middle schoolers. I know that when I was in middle school, Zoe Care was the group that came in and taught me about sex ed. So that's also an important thing to remember, that these young children are getting this information that is very religiously biased. And it's just important to know that not all children are going to hold true to that. Everybody has their own opinion and belief and value system and everything along those lines. So it's also important to remember that going with sex.
And on some of those other sexuality related pieces, when we talked about things like gender and consent and sexual orientation and healthy relationships and that sort of thing. Other groups that are teaching those sorts of topics in this area, we've mentioned Haven, who we co-facilitate our peer education group with, and that literally means our kids spend half their time learning about sexual health specifically, and half their time, as Alexina mentioned at the beginning, learning about healthy relationships and consent and coercion and all that stuff. Haven does teach to some of the local high schools to talk to kids about that. And the Voice Center on campus does a lot of work around consent and healthy relationships up there on campus. And then I've had the opportunity, luckily, to teach with the Help Center in a couple of instances. The Help Center has a specific piece of it called the Sexual Assault Counseling Center. It's housed within the Help Center. And so I've had the opportunity to teach with them to provide consent education to high school students, and that they can be a great resource as well to help kids understand what the difference is between, you know, sexual assault and sexual harassment, and how to intervene and how to just be a good human and only have sex with people that want to have sex with you and not be coercing each other into things they don't want to do. And then outside of the school system, the only thing that we know that exists to teach kids about sexual education is a program called Our Whole Lives. And Our Whole Lives, which is often abbreviated as OWL, is taught through the Pilgrim Congregational Church and the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bozeman. It's designed, they have different age groups that kids can go through to take this education. So they've got kids, kindergarten and first grade can go through it, 4 through 6 grades, 7 through 9th grades, and 10 through 12th grades get lumped together. And they might offer one that's for young adults even. I'm not sure about that. But these are like, it's a big curriculum. They do 8 to 12 sessions with each grade level. And to the best of our knowledge, it is very LGBTQ inclusive and it is comprehensive. It teaches young kids their anatomically correct body parts. It doesn't teach them, you know, that their vulva is their cupcake, which is a problem because if somebody is touching their cupcake, their teacher will say, stop touching their cupcake. But if a kid says, yeah, that kid is touching my vulva, that's a whole other thing that we need to know that is happening to them. Our Whole Lives curriculum also talks about how different families can be. They do cover contraception. They do talk about condoms, obviously in an age-appropriate way. So they aren't talking to kindergartners about condoms. They're talking to kindergartners about very different things. But it tends to be a very not shaming curriculum that does reiterate that having sex is a very big decision, as Sadie already mentioned. So there are different places in town that offer different types of sex education. And again, always just encouraging parents to know what is being taught and to make sure to supplement it if that is necessary. And the state of Montana does not require that parents even be notified that their children are learning sex education, but all of the schools that we teach in, parents are notified and are able to either opt out or opt their kids in. So definitely when the time comes that your kids bring home that sheet to opt out or opt in, you can always call the school and say, can I see a copy of the curriculum of what my child will be taught? So you can make a decision about if it's something that you think fits with your values and what else you may need to be teaching them on top of it. So I just want to say thank you super fast to Alexina and Sadie for being, first of all, for being their amazing selves. It's often one of those things that people say, they seem so young and they have so much knowledge. And I'm like, I know, right? I love to be able to harness that for good. So thank you too for joining us and for all your expertise.
Yeah, thank you.